in Maysia, so that if you have this, I think if you keep this map next to you as you are studying this particular problem, the whole thing will be far more meaningful to you if you know where these things are about which the authors will be writing. Today, then, we are on point E. Beginning with part three, we have a larger type. I hope that you can still read this, these items here enough today, just for these, for the completion of Leo. Leo the Great, 440 to 461. You remember that the Council of Chalcedon is 451. It was here, number one, that Leo took the theological leadership that from this time forth will mark the claims of Rome to her position in the church. Secondly, as we said last time, Leo breaks the alliance that had been maintained between the church in Rome and the church in Alexandria. This results, at least in part, from the fact that the Bishop of Alexandria at this time had fallen into what will become known as the Monophysitic heresy in attempting to defend the position of Eutyches. You recall that from last quarter. It also results in part from the fact that Alexandria would not confirm the position of Rome about the Sardican canon being part of the Nicene canon. This ends an axis. Also a part of this is the fact that Bishop Leo and the successor of Theodosius II in Constantinople, Marcion, through his sister, were close friends. So that from now on you get an alliance, as we will see, especially in the next, in part three, an alliance between Rome and the powers that be in Constantinople, both civil and ecclesiastical. And Alexandria passes out of the picture as the great ally of Rome. It's a very important shift. But Rome allies herself with the strongest power. Whether this was premeditated or not, of course, is debatable. But Alexandria now passes out as a mighty influence in the church that she had been prior to the Council of Ephesus in 430, or even prior to the Council of Ephesus in 449. From now on, Rome always needs to reckon with Constantinople, with whom Leo welds at least this theological alliance. Then we said, thirdly, that Leo appeals to Peter. This is a most important aspect of Leo's papacy, that he does not appeal merely to the fact that he is the successor of Peter, but to the privileges of Peter that result from the fact that the spirit of Peter, the authority of Peter, dwells within the Bishop of Rome, so that when the Bishop of Rome speaks, Peter speaks. In his letter to Chalcedon, Leo said, "In this manner, beloved, is today's festival celebrated with reasonable service, when in my humble self he is indeed honored in whom abides the care of all the shepherds and of the flocks committed to them," that is, the shepherds. So he separates himself from all of the other bishops in Christendom. They are all in his care. This devotion is shown in the first place to him whom they know to be the head of this see, the primate of all bishops. Peter ceases not to be the head of this see, in that he has obtained unfailing fellowship with the eternal priest, that stability which he, being made a rock, has received from Christ the rock, he conveys to his successor. And when aught of stability is shown, there is without doubt, there without doubt is seen the strength
of the shepherd.
In other words, this is the pride. If you read Duchesne's History of the Early Christian Church, a great modern Roman Catholic scholar on this subject, he will point now to Leo's theological stability and will infer from this that this is one of the reasons why Rome attained to the high position that she has within the church. Then, let's take five next, and then move back to four. Then you have the constant tendency on the part of Leo to expand the influence, the direct ecclesiastical influence of Rome. What happened in Africa under Innocent and his successors, Zosimus and Sextus, in Africa under Leo now takes place in Gaul, where Leo suggests that the bishops of Gaul can appeal directly to the Bishop of Rome and need not go through the Hilary, who was sort of the suzerain bishop in Gaul at this time. I believe he was at Lyon, if I recall correctly. In other words, that they could appeal directly to Rome. We have a good number of letters there, correspondence between Hilary and Leo, where this kind of direct interference without appeal on the part of a diocesan council is had by Rome. Now, then four should become number five. By this time, there is really no authority that can really substantiate or deny with any degree of power this claim of Leo. And you find claims being made after the time of Leo by the Roman bishop that are, some of them just have no reality. They are simply claims and no more than this. When Leo interferes in Gaul, when his predecessors interfered in Africa, there was, at least prior to this time, always the Roman power, the power of the Roman emperor, that could say either the Bishop of Rome is right or the Bishop of Rome is wrong. This no longer obtains. Now, it's true that the emperor in the West, Valentinian III, sustained Leo in his efforts against Hilary in Gaul. That is, he suggested that Rome did have the right to interfere, and that what the bishops in Gaul did had to conform to the wishes of the Bishop of Rome, whether or not it conformed to the wishes of Hilary. You find this famous edict of Valentinian III on pages 32 and 33 of Bettinson. Therefore, it says, this is the Western emperor talking now. He's not a very great one, but at least he is speaking. Therefore, inasmuch as the preeminence of the apostolic see is assured by the merit of St. Peter, the first of the bishops, by the leading position of the Church of Rome, and also by the authority of the Holy Synod, let not presumption strive to attempt anything contrary to the authority of that see. Then you can read this on your own. Then toward the end of this famous edict, therefore, in the first place, we put down so great a crime, and beyond that, in order that no disturbance, however slight, might arise among the churches, and the discipline of religion may not appear to be impaired in any case whatsoever, we decree by a perpetual edict that nothing shall be attempted by the Gallican bishops or by those in any other province contrary to ancient custom without the authority of the venerable Pope of the Eternal City. Now, this makes Rome prime in a sense that they had claimed, at least that was claimed already by Julius, that nothing can be done in any diocese to which Rome does not agree, whether or not Rome has been appealed to. But this is only Valentinian III saying this. who was the Western emperor, and this is not recognized by Eastern Christendom, nor by the Eastern emperor as being the case. And this is evidenced very clearly by the decrees of Chalcedon, which you find on pages 115 and 116, which was suggested just as it had already been suggested in 381 at Constantinople, that in jurisdiction all of the great bishops of the church are equal. That is, if you are living in the East, you do not appeal to the Bishop of Rome. You appeal to the Bishop of Constantinople, or the Bishop of Antioch, or the Bishop of Alexandria. And then Chalcedon goes on to suggest that once you have appealed to Alexandria and to Antioch, then the next step is to appeal to Constantinople. You see, so it sort of puts Constantinople and Rome on equal grounds. What Rome is in the West, Constantinople is in the East. The only primacy that Rome retains, according to Chalcedon, and this is the only kind of primacy that the Eastern Orthodox Church is willing to this very day to give to the Roman bishop, is the ancient primacy of honor, or preeminence. And that is spelled out by Chalcedon. And when you talk about, as we will see again later on in this course, when you talk about any reunification between the Roman West and the Orthodox East, one has to get over this great gulf, the gulf of the powers of the papacy. This is also, of course, one of the problems that separates Roman Catholicism from Protestantism in general. Now we come to the next major phase of papal development. I call this the course of supremacy. As you think of the course of a river, as this idea of supremacy continues to as Rome continues to accumulate powers, but in a different sense now, after Leo, with the civil authority, especially in the West, in a constant state of flux, and the civil authority in the East so far away, the whole problem of the authority of Rome, not only of the Bishop of Rome vis-a-vis the other bishops of Christendom, but the authority of the Roman bishop as a temporal ruler in the world, and therefore vis-a-vis civil authorities, wherever they might be in the Roman Empire. Now this again is something, a term that is very difficult to define. It's very difficult to suggest precisely when this course of supremacy, that is, where Rome is conscious of the fact that she must establish herself over against the civil authorities of the world, just as she must establish herself over against the other bishops in Christendom. Just exactly where you would begin this is a matter of a great debate. But I think we can at least suggest that it becomes very obvious after Leo, because it was in 410, of course, that the Goths sacked Rome, and then during the pontificate of Leo, Rome was sacked two more times, as you probably recall. And it was only at the because of the role that Leo played, it is said, that worse damage was not done in Italy, much less in the city of Rome itself. Maybe I overstated myself when I say that Rome was sacked. In any case, Italy was. How much of Rome was spared was the result of Leo's intervention. Now, that you have a new thing taking place here, what I call supremacy as distinct from primacy, is a result of the fact that imperial authority in the West is no longer what it was. And this is a result of the Volkwanderung, the barbarian Germanic, I don't like to use the word barbarian here, but the Germanic wanderings that ultimately are into the northern frontier of the Roman Empire, and ultimately then they are taken in to the, they become the authority, the Roman authority in the West, as we will see under B. Now the first group that becomes important, influential in the Roman Empire are the Visigoths, the Western Goths, a Germanic tribe. This group, either the Visigoths, ultimately the Ostrogoths, then the Lombards, and finally the Franks. Don't try to put all this down because it's coming. But these groups are now, they become the civil authority in the empire and are consequently the authority with which the ecclesiastical authority must work and over against which the ecclesiastical authority must establish itself. I think it's important to see that these Visigoths, by the time all of this takes place, were both Romanized and Christianized. This is why I hesitate to use the word barbarian. I think Henri Pirenne, in his studies, and all of the students of Pirenne, P-I-R-E-N-N-E, among whom are certainly some of these works that we have recommended, like Ferdinand Lott, and even Christopher Dawson, and Bark, these scholars who have worked either in cooperation with or as direct students of this great French scholar, Henri Pirenne, who pointed out that we shouldn't think of these Germanic tribes as barbarians. I always will remember having been taught Ammianus Marcellinus' description of the Huns, people who eat and sleep and make love on horseback. This is the way I learned to understand what the Germanic peoples were like, and this, as Pirenne, I think, demonstrates, is hardly the case. They were Romanized. When Alaric the Visigoth comes to Italy in the first decades of the 5th century, having been in Greece prior to that time, he speaks Latin and speaks it well. He was anxious to see the city of Athens and the city of Rome because he had read and studied so much about it. He saluted the statues of Phidias in Athens, in the Pantheon, Parthenon rather. He asked that a Platonic dialogue, the Timaeus, be read to him, and he wanted to see one of the great Greek plays. You normally don't think of a barbarian as being interested in this kind of thing. What Alaric wanted more than anything else was to be recognized as the civil authority, was to be given a title, perhaps the title of consul, to become part of the Roman government, rather than to destroy Rome. That was not the purpose of the Goths at all. Most of them were soldiers, What he wanted was a place in the Roman government. Well, there are many more things we could say here about the fact that these Goths, the individuals who are in the forefront of the Germanic movement into the empire, to demonstrate that they were, at least the leadership, was Romanized. They had been wandering around and living on the northern fringes of the Roman Empire for generations by the beginning of the 5th century, ever since the 3rd century at the very latest, and consequently had many, many generations in which to be thoroughly Romanized. They were also Christianized. We tend sometimes, I think, to underestimate this. I don't think we can if we have studied thoroughly Augustine's City of God. The Goths were Christians of the Arian brand, but still Christians. This was the work, as you recall, originally of the missionary Eupholus, or Wulfilus, Little Wolf, who was sent out by the council at Antioch in 343. The Council of Antioch is often considered an Arianizing council. This is not really true. The Council of Antioch represented what we call the Eusebian position rather than the Arian position. But I think we can say without fear of contradiction that Eupholus's understanding of the place of Christ in the economy of the Godhead was really Arian. It may have been an uneducated kind of Arianism, or an Arianism because it was a simplified kind of Christianity. But he did think of the Son as clearly subordinate to the Father and intermediary. This is very important because what makes it very difficult for the Catholic Christians, and especially the Bishop of Rome, to deal with these Germanic peoples is the fact that they are heretics, that they all claim to be Arians. Whether this is an educated claim or not, this is what they claim to be. Eupholus, I don't know whether one can overestimate the importance of a man like this. He is a known missionary. We know the names of so few of the early Christian missionaries. Once he brings about the conversion of this front running, we might say, Germanic tribe to Christianity, the rest of the tribes are converted by a sort of chain reaction as the decades go by. But he is the first to bring, at least the first name that we have, of an individual who brought Christianity to these German people. He also translated the Holy Scripture into Gothic. Just as he is quite independent of the various kinds of debates about the place of Christ that were going on within the Roman Empire, he thought of this. He called these the whole struggle at Nicaea and in the years following vain altercations. He had very little use for all this kind of argument. Spoke of Christ very biblically. Was not willing to use either homoousios or homoiousios. And this, of course, is the source of his vaunted Arianism. What he actually thought is perhaps unimportant because of the fact that he gives the Germanic Christianity this title, and that becomes the problem. In any case, just as he was quite independent over against these debates that were going on about Christianity within the empire, so he's quite independent in how he translated the scripture. If he didn't think that a particular part of scripture was good for the minds of these Germanic peoples, he left it out. And this is why the books of Kings are not to be found in the Gothic, in Eupholus's Gothic translation. He said these Germanic peoples know enough about military exploits. We don't have to teach them that here in religion. they're fond enough of war. So let's not put the warfare stories from the Old Testament into their holy book. And he didn't. Here you have the Bible translated into Gothic. The next great step, of course, will be translating the Bible into Slavic. And this we will look at, we will be noting later on. Now, once these Goths, these Germanic people, come into the empire, you have this massive shift taking place in the center of Western civilization. Western civilization becomes European now, as the Roman Empire absorbs these new ethnic, national, if you want to call them that, national groups. The center of Western civilization is no longer the Mediterranean. It's no longer a sea civilization. This is another one of the things that Pyrrhon has pointed out so lucidly. But now becomes a land civilization, agricultural and European, rather than Mediterranean. This is in great part the result of this assimilation of these new groups that find their way into the West. Now, the important point of all of important point about all of this for our purposes here is that when all of this takes place, the civil authority is in a state of flux, and when this is happening, the one great stable focal point becomes the local priest and the bishop, and especially the Bishop of Rome. These individuals become symbols of that which is stable in the midst of all of this flux that is taking place in the West. Now, how good an argument all of this is, I'm not willing to vouch for all of this, but you find it in all of the history books. I suppose one would have to study all of this literature very carefully to be able to defend the validity of all of this. But when you're talking about the rise of the authority of Rome, both in the West, especially in the West, rather, the fact that Rome is a stable factor, the fact that Rome can maintain itself, that there is a succession of bishops in Rome, and that there are bishops in all of these sees of Christendom in succession, and that in the face of this movement of people in Western Europe, that this spiritual authority not only remains, but just simply absorbs to itself various facets of temporal authority, the kind of thing that the bishop, the priest, the local priest has continued to do in the various cities and villages of Europe to the present day, keeping records, things of this sort. All of this comes about when there is no civil authority any longer to do this. This falls to the lot of the church. And Justinian, in 554, recognizes this by giving clergy the status of civil officials, which they will retain from this time forth in medieval history. Now, if you keep this in mind, that you have clergy now acting as civil officials, and all of the clergy in the West look in one way or another to the Bishop of Rome as the real, true authority in the face of all of the varied leadership that comes about with the kind of Volkswanderung that was going on during this period, one can see how this plays in a very important role in the rise of the Roman position. Clergy could maintain their position in Italy as well as in Gaul because they were exempt from taxation and from civil service. if you that element, which if anything destroys the economic classes in Europe, the middle class as we would perhaps think of it, the landed classes in Europe, it's the high taxation of this Roman authority as it faces the barbarian tribes in these intermittent combats. The clergy are exempt from this and consequently retain their wealth and consequently the authority that is attached to this. The ecclesiastical courts that had developed by this time, growing out of the system of penance, as we have learned about it already in the early church, maintained themselves. When the civil courts, when the Roman consul is nowhere to be found because his position has been usurped by Germanic authority or by the Germanic tyranny, I suppose we would say, the ecclesiastical courts remain. Churches always remain sanctuaries, centers of refuge for those who were in some kind of political difficulty. Well, all of these things together, coupled finally with the fact that you have great bishops in the 4th and the 5th centuries. To name all of them would take very much time, but we have very many names from this period. And as you read the history of the Franks by Gregory of Tours, for example, or even Jordanus's history of the Goths, or the history of the Lombards, you see as you read these histories again and again how a bishop is finally the individual who comes out as the one authority that remains in a given area. And as I have already suggested, he looks to the Bishop of Rome as his superior. Now, as I say, to spell all of this out in greater detail, you can question this, I suppose, in one area or another. But I think, overall, the thesis has a lot of merit to it. And certainly, is very important as we think of the growing role of ecclesiastical authority culminating in the Bishop of Rome in Western civilization. Now, the Bishop of Rome himself always allies, I think we can probably pull this down here. Yeah, just leave this off. Because I think you have to see all three points here to get what I'm going to be driving at. The Roman bishop, the Bishop of Rome, after Leo, always allies with that power which is able to maintain order. And this, of course, has become the mark of the Bishop of Rome also in the modern period. We are getting quite a bit of material right now about Pius the 12th. And his dealings with Hitler, as you probably are, with which you are probably already familiar. This is the way that Roman bishop, the Bishop of Rome, has operated with temporal powers all the way back to the 5th century. It wasn't necessary so much for Leo to deal with the Visigoths because this was a passing power. When Alaric dies immediately after the sack of Rome in the beginning of the 5th century, the Visigoths just they settle in Languedoc in South Gaul in North Spain, what is Southern Gaul and Northern Spain today, and that's the end of the Visigoths as far as a power is concerned. Leo continues to look toward his great ally in Constantinople. But then the Visigoths are followed by the Ostrogoths. Then the Eastern authority reasserts itself again in Justinian between the dates around 530 and 570. And then Justinian's power after Justinian dies and he's unwilling any longer to defend his conquests in the West, Italy is taken over by the Lombards. Now, the Bishop of Rome simply allies himself with these various powers that be, these powers that are able to maintain order in sequence. First of all, with the Ostrogoths, and down till the time when Justinian, in the middle of the 20s of the 6th century, attempts to recapture the whole Roman Empire via his generals, as you know, Belisarius and Narses. If you've never read that story, that's the most fascinating one. But prior to that time, the Roman authority in Constantinople designates one official to represent him in Italy. And the official that was chosen by the Eastern Emperor at this time, in the beginning of the fifth, the end of the fifth century, was Theodoric, the Ostrogoth. He had the army. Indeed, he was sent from Constantinople to get rid of a very obstreperous leader in the West, Odoacer, who wasn't seemingly able to take orders from Constantinople. And so Theodoric was sent to get rid of him. He does this by going to the West and making a treaty with him, first of all. And then they sit down at a banquet together. And at that banquet, Theodoric kills Odoacer. And when he does it, he said, "This is revenge for what you have done to my kindred." Odoacer did not ally himself with the power of the Ostrogoths, but with other powers, and consequently many of Theodoric's kindred had been butchered by Odoacer. And then when he started his sword from the top of Odoacer's head and it went all the way down to the bottom without stopping, Theodoric was supposed to have said, "Methinks this man has no bones at all." This is an interesting banquet. In any case, it was this individual who is the representative of Eastern authority and that power which is able to maintain law in the West. Now, that's what I learned about Theodoric. But there is much more about this man that, unfortunately, we, back in our high school and college days, either were not taught or somehow didn't catch. And I have a feeling that it was the former because it is the emphasis that has been coming through in the most recent material. And that is that Theodoric, too, was a highly civilized individual. He had grown up in Constantinople. He was a Roman. He was a Christian, also an Arian Christian, but he was all of these things. One of the individuals in Theodoric's court was Cassiodorus, and his variae, his letters, and he also wrote, by the way, a history of the Goths, emphasizing the Ostrogoths. We don't have that history anymore, except in fragments. But Cassiodorus, who is no unimportant figure in the early Middle Ages, was Theodoric's secretary. And through the writings of Cassiodorus, we get something of an insight into the mind of this Ostrogoth, how he hoped that the old Roman, who was so proud of his civilitas, could somehow learn to live in peace with the Germans, with the Goths, and that they could form one civilization in the West. He says in one place, for example, that you make the laws and we will defend them. And maybe on that basis we can live together. He was no mean thinker. He wasn't a philosopher or anything of that sort. But he wasn't a barbarian either. And he was clearly a Christian, though an Arian. He built many churches, for example, in Italy. He is one of those who defend the authority of the Bishop of Rome in Italy. When two men vie for the succession to the papacy, Theodoric said, "You are the one who is to judge all others." Tells this to the Roman bishop. You cannot afford to be divided in your judgment. But ultimately, it is necessary for Theodoric to do what he insisted, first of all, he would not do, just as Constantine had insisted. He was forced to choose between which of the two men was actually the Bishop of Rome. But once this was done, this man had all of the aura and authority that associated itself with ecclesiastical leadership. One historian has said that Theodoric, quote, was far more true to the Roman ideal than various of his Roman predecessors had been. Now, that's an equivocal kind of statement by itself. But what it is meant to say is that he is a true representative of all that we think of as the Roman genius for government and for order. and should not simply be classified with a barbarian. Well, this was the Ostrogoth, controlling Italy from the end of the 5th through the first quarter of the 6th century. Then Justinian reconquers Italy in the midst of the 6th century. Narses, who is not able to hold his conquest, the conquest of Belisarius, is forced to ask help from the Lombards, another tribe that had found its way, especially into North Italy, into the northern areas of Italy. Here, I think your map will be somewhat helpful to you. They were in Rhaetia and Noricum. We'll be using this map in almost every class to point out areas like this over in here, in the northeastern part of Italy. He was forced to call upon them for military help. Well, when Justinian dies then, it is the Lombards who take over, and once again, the Roman bishop allies with them. They are Catholic, at least after Queen Theodolinda is able to convert the leader of the Lombards, whose name is rather unimportant for our purposes. Prior to that, the Lombards had been pagan. They are not Arian. I think this is quite important. But the Lombard power was not willing, ultimately, to work with the papacy, as we will see. And it is always necessary for the Bishop of Rome to play off the Lombard power against the remaining authority of the Eastern Emperor in Italy, as well as other tribes, such as the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the remaining vintage of these groups, and then finally the Franks. So that really the Lombards were not a controllable quantity, and therefore no lasting relationship is made between them and the papacy. What I suppose is of lasting importance concerning the Lombards is that they divided Italy into duchies. These remain as more or less as political units through medieval history. They are constantly fighting throughout the Middle Ages for the control of the papacy. One of these duchies then becomes the papal state once the Lombard power is no more in Italy. So that for that reason, I think we should note. The main point is that the Bishop of Rome always allies himself with one of these, with the power that is able to maintain order in Italy successively. Now, the one great example that we have of this kind of activity is the Pope Gregory the Great, and we want to look at him now, who is Pope in Italy from 590 through 604. Pardon? You mean you didn't get it? I'm sorry. Is that what you wanted? All right. Then we can maybe put this down here. The Gregory the Great is, of course, one of the most important bishops of all time. Luther dated the beginning of the papacy with Gregory. When Melanchthon describes what he is doing, he says, all of the theology that is now passing away is exemplified in this individual Gregory. And I think when Luther calls Gregory the first pope, this is what he is primarily talking about, the theological position of Gregory, which was synergistic rather than a thorough knowledge, as I think Headley and Schaefer, who have written books on Luther's knowledge of church history, have amply demonstrated. Luther wasn't that much of a church historian. In any case, no one will quarrel with the fact that he is among the greatest bishops of Rome. His dates are very important, 590 to 604. What you find in Gregory is the most clear example of a bishop whose understanding of his ecclesiastical and political position revolves around maintaining, retaining, expanding his ability to act independently. This remains, I think, true today. I just finished working through Father Hughes's history of the Ecumenical Council. And so often, this particular item recurs, even where I suppose a Protestant historian, a Lutheran historian, wouldn't find any particular reference to this particular problem. He finds it, because this is so much a part of the whole political thinking of the Roman bishop, the Roman pope. Gregory, in all of his activities, insists that he has the ability to act independently. This means, A, that the spiritual cannot be judged by the temporal power. Essentially, when bishops say that, and this had been said already by Leo and by Gelasius and other bishops prior to Gregory, what they are essentially saying is not so much that the spiritual is to rule the temporal, but rather that the temporal power cannot interfere with the independent activity of the spiritual power. And then, related to this, there is obviously then no ecclesiastical authority anywhere that can sit in the judgment of the Bishop of Rome. It's very interesting how much Theodoric understood this. And Ennodius, who was a bishop during the time of Theodoric, how in their writings you find this theme coming through, that there is no ecclesiastical authority. The Bishop of Rome cannot be judged. He is always judge, and once he is spoken, that is it. Now these two things, both over against the state, the civil authority, as well as over against ecclesiastical authority, is that which Gregory is attempting to defend. Now, the authority then in the ecclesiastical circle, first of all. Here Gregory finds himself in conflict with the patriarch, the ecumenical bishop of Constantinople. John the Faster takes this title, which would imply that he had powers equal to those of Peter. This is the way Leo had always suggested that Peter differed from the other disciples. This is why our Lord gives to Peter a special kind of power. The other disciples were bishops of a given area. This is what our Lord means to do when he breathes the Spirit on each of them. But when he says this special thing to Peter, giving him the keys and all of this kind of thing, what he means to say there is that where everyone else is a bishop of a given area, Peter is the bishop of the whole church. Now, when the bishop of Constantinople takes this title, ecumenical bishop, bishop of bishops, Gregory, in irony, says that he does not claim to be a bishop of bishops. He only claims to be the servant of the servants. But it's with the time of Gregory the Great, not completely, but certainly with this time, that the term Pope, Papa, is now reserved for the Bishop of Rome. Prior to this time, the time of Augustine, Ambrose, Jerome, and certainly before that, many of the bishops in Christendom had been referred to as Papa. Now this title is reserved for the Bishop of Rome to indicate that he is an ecumenical bishop, unlike all other bishops in the church. Thank you for your attention.